As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Surveillance Economics.
Productivity is the key to real GDP growth.
Our view is that inflation is going to be moving higher, but it's going to be moving higher on a gradual basis.
Finance.
I don't think there's a reason to expect the dollar to keep going up.
We don't realize how good times are now.
Investment.
I'm very pessimistic on stocks. I'm very pessimistic on bonds.
If you're a longer-term investor, you just want to stay long.
Bloomberg Surveillance with Tom Keene and Jonathan Farrow on Bloomberg Radio.
From New York City for our audience worldwide, good morning, good morning. This is Bloomberg Surveillance. Alongside Tom Keene, I'm Jonathan Farrow. President Trump picking a loyalist to replace Cohen. Kudlow signaling he supports a tough stance on China. The Senate backing a bill to relax post-crisis rules, giving smaller banks a break, offering Wall Street very little. And drowning in debt, crushed by competition, the Toys R Us turnaround collapses after turnaround efforts fail. In the markets, your Thursday morning price action as follows. Futures up 14 on the Dow, unchanged on the S&P 500. In the FX market, some muted price action, but some yen strength in there, with dollar yen down for a second straight day. We dropped south of 106 at 105.89, down 0.4%. In the bond market, is there some stormy weather brewing in Shortsville? Treasuries yields lower by another basis points to almost 280 on a US 10-year. At the front end of the curve, we're unchanged at 2.25%. And to round things out for you in the commodity market, Brent unchanged at $64.91 and WTI positive by just a mere 0.2% at $61 and around about 10 cents. The main story worldwide is still very much China, with the question, one question on many people's minds. How does the United States counter China? In a period of just 24 hours, the struggles were very much underlined. In Beijing, President Xi was consolidating power, unveiling a sweeping diplomatic overhaul to help deliver a decade-long plan. In Washington, the president fired his top diplomat by tweet, laying bare months of policy disputes. I'm really pleased to say that weighing in this morning on Bloomberg Surveillance is Stephen Roach, the Yale University professor, formerly chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia, and the firm's economist for much of his 30-year career at the company. He joins us now. Professor, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how does the United States counter the Chinese approach in international trade?
Well, there's several things we got to do. Number one, Jonathan, we have to restart the formal engagement on economic matters. We used to have something called the Strategic and Economic Dialogue. It morphed into the Comprehensive Economic Dialogue, and now it's on hold, and we really don't talk. We don't need a bunch of annual sort of event planning exercises. We need a permanent secretariat to really engage the Chinese on a regular basis, number one. Number two, we've got to focus on market access. And there we've had a negotiation stalled for 9 years on a bilateral investment treaty, which would allow us and our multinationals to have greater access to rapidly growing consumer markets in China. We are stymied on this. The Chinese are also part of this. They want access to our markets. Let's, if we have a president who does deals, let's do a deal to allow companies on both sides to actively participate. And thirdly, there's a number of softer policy issues that need to be addressed. We talked about them on television a few minutes ago. The U.S. is completely off base in viewing the Chinese bilateral deficit in isolation from its multilateral current account and savings problems. We've got to get economic analysis back into the issue. And the Chinese have soft issues of their own to address in terms of their geostrategic intentions,
their trading
practice issues, and cyber issues as well. China's reputation amongst the intellectual thought leader base in the United States is probably at an all-time low right now, and China needs to counter that with more effective and reasoned responses on their side.
How do you expect the Chinese to counter the events of the last month, Professor? Because they have been remarkably quiet in the face of heightened criticism worldwide.
Well, they've been quiet because the actions to date have not really been of enormous consequence. The big shoe to fall would be, Jonathan, if the president does impose much higher and broader tariffs as part of the so-called Section 301 negotiations that his trade representative has been working on since last August in areas like intellectual property rights, technology transfer, and innovation. And, you know, the rumor, not so secret, coming out of Washington is that big tariffs are coming in response to that. And if the Chinese are hit with much bigger tariffs,
right,
they will most assuredly retaliate. And we'll see how we like it when our third largest and most rapidly growing export market puts tariffs on U.S.
Right.
companies, including Boeing.
Steve Roach, to me, the thing that's most charming is a complete misunderstanding of game theory. And I'm not talking about the sophistication of Avinash Dixit down at Princeton University or the wonderful program at Rice University. I'm just talking about basic response. Mr. Navarro and Mr. Ross seem to be unaware that China will respond. How will China respond? What is the game theory that Steve Roach observes or can predict from Beijing?
China, we have a codependent economic relationship with China, which means that they depend on our markets to sell their goods, but we also depend on products from China to make ends meet for hard-pressed consumers. And by the way, we depend hugely every year on Chinese buying of treasuries to fund our budget deficit, which is, of course, going to get considerably larger in the years ahead. So China's got a number of options that it can think about in response to U.S. pressure.
Okay, they banned
on the trade front or on the capital flow front.
I mean, you should see John Farrell going down Fifth Avenue on a Harley Davidson. It's really something. If they put a tariff on Harley Davidsons, what's the effect on that for both parties?
Well, you won't see John riding his Harley in Beijing.
Or it'll just get a little bit more expensive.
Well, who knows? I think, again, the U.S. Is looking for sources of growth.
Yeah.
And our two biggest trading partners are Mexico and Canada. Number three, in terms of, and number one, in terms of actual growth over the last 10 years, is China. China's changing its economy, Tom. They're becoming more of a middle-class consumption economy, which is a huge potential market for us in terms of both goods and services, provided we do a deal on market access through the bilateral investment treaty that I just alluded to. So that should be the focus. And, you know, the Chinese can choke off that option if we play tough with them. So you're right. There is no real game theoretic mindset in Washington. They view it as a one-way street. You know, we can stop China irrespective of the consequences that may have on us.
Professor, at the moment, though, that development in China is largely seen as a threat. Made in China 2025, this big decade-long plan, is seen as a threat, not just by the United States of America, but by Europe as well, and perhaps Germany more specifically. You keep talking about the benefits of this relationship with China, and I look at the current administration and wonder whether they identify enough shared interests right now to really counter the areas of friction. Do they?
Look, those are great questions. Industrial policy, whether it was sponsored by the Japanese in the 80s or now the Chinese right now, has been viewed as a threat for systems like ours that are based on the creative destruction of Joseph Schumpeter. The market knows a lot more, but we get engaged a lot in industrial policy. Just look at what the Trump administration did with respect to this Qualcomm deal as well, and look at what we've done repeatedly in intervening in what we think are our strategic interests through CFIUS and other organizations that control the way in which other companies operate in our space. So we're all guilty of intervening in markets. And, you know, the Chinese do have this strategic plan made in China 2025. But look, there's no guarantee it's actually going to work out exactly as they say. They've got to do a lot of innovation. They're going to move up the value chain. They're going to be moving into new industries. They're going to put a lot of government support into these industries like, you know, biotech and information technology and environmental remediation. But there's no guarantee it's going to work if they don't have the innovation and the breakthroughs to really bring these industries to the next place.
Stephen Roach, it's great to have you with us, the Yale University professor, former chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia, and the firm's economist for much of his 30-year career.
It's an annual visit that we do with Douglas Cass of Seabreeze. We do this for the brackets. We do this for spring training in his Florida. Cass visiting all the stadia of the Grapefruit League, and we talked to him about the equity markets as well. Doug, who do you have in your bracket, please? Let's get that out of the way.
On the right side of the bracket, I'm all Philly. Villanova versus Pennsylvania. Penn Quakers. Go Quakers.
You the got semis. The Penn Quakers.
I'm being facetious. I'm being facetious. I think Villanova goes all the way.
Okay. Very good. We're looking boiler up here. Purdue. John Farrow, Doug Cass is trying to find Purdue on the map.
I'm still waiting for someone to tell me why we say boiler up.
Well, Doug Cass, we'll get into that in history. We'll do that at our 10 o'clock. Our autopsy meeting this morning on boiler up. Doug Cass, boiler up these markets. Dow 25,000, everyone knows you've been more than cautious. Are you still short the market?
Yes. I've been long and short, but I see better than a 50% probability that we've seen a market top already this year.
Within that, is it about the economic growth fragilities that are percolating? Is it simply valuation, or is it Jerome Powell?
Well, I think history rhymes, and we discussed last time when I went long into the liquidity dry up owing to the unwind of short vol and risk parity trades in early February. And I compared it to the last liquidity event that I remember in October 1987 when portfolio insurance crashed the market. So if history rhymes, we have a rally off that. We have a retest, a rally, and a retest. I think we had the second rally already. I bought back my shorts, went long, sold into my target of around 2750. We had a bit of an overshoot. And where I stand now is I've been consistently, in the last week or so, reshorting the indices. I made the observation to you and to your producer, but my buddy Lee, that, you know, we live in this interconnected world, this flat world, so all geography, market geographies, should really correlate to each other. And I made the observation that the DAX is now back to where it was in March 2017, which will surprise a lot of people. Yeah. At that time, the S&P was about 425 points lower, so you get some sense of overvaluations. I don't think this is a divergence we can ignore. But there are other warning signs. Jonathan mentioned the strong bid in the Treasury market. High yield debt is starting to roll over. We're beginning to see the domestic economy stumbling a bit. And the more optimistic economic assumptions are not being confirmed by retail sales, durable goods, housing starts, automobile sales, which have peaked. And so there's a developing trend of disappointing economic data as well. It's also occurring in the EU, the last couple of data points.
You see it very pronounced in Europe, Doug.
Yeah. So I think the market may be the mirror image of the New York Yankees. In the latter case, the best is yet to come. In the former case, the market, the worst is yet to come.
Good morning, Bloomberg 106.1 FM Boston. On behalf of all, I apologize.
Boston,
please.
Seriously, Tom.
Come on. But explain to me, Doug, how the Orioles can pop off five or six in a row in the Grapefruit League. No one understands this world. John?
Spring training. Look, my eye is on the market. My heart is on DD and Wade and Bird and Sanchez and Hick. And we have to all stand up for the judge.
So we keep it on the market, Doug,
John,
just for a couple
us.
Of minutes.
John,
just for a couple
us.
Of minutes before everyone in Boston
turns off the radio. Doug, if we've come into the new year and everyone is completely over-enthusiastic about global synchronized growth, Europe picking up, the United States picking up, talk to me about whether, A, we've seen peak growth. From listening to you, you think we have. And two, whether we've seen the peak for the 10-year yield this year already.
I think we've seen peak expectations for growth. I think we are, market participants, Jonathan, are far too focused on the jobs report of last Friday. I would emphasize that employment data is a notoriously rearview mirror or lagging economic indicator. Yesterday morning, the Atlanta Fed said that the GDP model sees first quarter growth of only 1.9%, down from 2.5%. I would say that's fairly disappointing considering we have been in a respend and rebuilding period following the hurricanes, and we're now nearly 3 months past the passage of meaningful corporate tax cuts.
What do you say back to people, Doug, that say those tax cuts won't bite until the second quarter, the third quarter?
I don't understand why that would be the case.
Well, for a lot of people, they won't see it in their paychecks until later on this quarter.
Well, I speak to companies, Jonathan, yeah, and I don't see a meaningful change in their CapEx projections for fiscal and calendar 2018.
But this is something, we're going to do this with David Kelly here in a minute, but let's do it right now with Douglas Cass. Doug, you and I have seen this a jillion times, where you get a consensus, always deserved zeitgeist view, in this case, better economic growth, and it may be cyclical and short, it may be structural and long. Good morning, President Trump. Good morning, Mr. Kudlow. But Doug, the fact is, the percolation in research is it may not be there. That has a profound ramification on Fed tone and market tone, doesn't it?
I'm beginning to think, Tom, that we're going to see a two or less rate increases, which is far below consensus.
Yes.
This consensus, Jonathan, is what I call groupthink. And particularly at a flinch, if you can identify inflection points, you can make a great deal of money. And then now we have this optimism about my good buddy, pal, friend Larry Kudlow, which we should discuss.
Well, Doug, let's just because of time, we got to rip up the script here. You and I have known Larry for years. Can Larry talk back to the president? Because the critics say he's just going to mouth the Trump mandate. Isn't his job to say, "Wait a minute, Mr. President"?
Right. My relationship with Larry runs deep. I've been on the Kudlow Report when it existed over 50 times, maybe 20 times on his radio show. He was at my son's wedding. That's how close we are. I think on numerous grounds, this is a very different administration than Larry is joining as compared to the one that he left when he was working with Reagan years ago. I don't think it changed Trump's mind, which is strong and long held. He comes with these quick policy decisions and seems to stick with them. So speaking truth to his power is almost an insurmountable objective for Larry with Trump, in my opinion.
What's the objective?
I think his role is going to primarily be in marketing, selling the tax package, and secondarily working with Ross and Navarro towards a sensible trade policy. Thirdly, he's going to obviously bridge Washington and Wall Street and the business communities, which he'll be good at. But I ask you the following questions. Look, Larry has met more than anyone I know, and this is why I respect him. He has overcome challenges in the past, but this mountain is really high. Everyone is saying, especially on your competing network, CNBC, where he worked, that Larry will have the upper hand against Navarro and Ross. I would ask, if Cohen, the former president of Goldman Sachs, did not have the upper hand over Ross and Navarro,
right,
why should we expect Larry, okay, a business media commentator, to have,
right,
the upper hand?
Okay, I got to go here for Boston. I got an email here from Boston 1061 FM. Where should Aaron Judge be in the Yankees lineup? Isn't he like the ultimate leadoff hitter?
Would you please? He's going to back third.
Bet third, okay. It'll be magnificent. I hope to be down there in a couple days. Maybe, Doug, I'll run into you at Steinbrenner Field. Douglas Cass, Seabreeze Partners, with us this morning. Thank you for those comments.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Well, a change in the White House and in advisors to the president when it comes to economic policy, and perhaps even a change in markets. Gina Martin Adams is a Bloomberg intelligence expert when it comes to all things related to economics and the markets. Gina, always a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having
maybe
me.
Just let's talk a little bit about contradictions or seemingly contradictions. On the one hand, you have an administration that is imposing tariffs on the imports of foreign manufactured steel and aluminum. Also, there's a conversation, more than a conversation, I bet, about tariffs or preventing automobiles from being shipped to the United States for U.S. consumers. Now you have Mr. Larry Kudlow, who is going to be joining the administration and has in the past, I believe, been a, quote, free trader.
Right.
How do you square those two things at a time when the budget deficit in the United States is ballooning?
It's going to be tricky. I mean, I think as with all things with this particular administration, it's really tough to get a consistent read on where things are headed. I think if I were to take a stab at how Kudlow will position this, it is probably going to be positioned as a president that is attempting to negotiate better trade relations, not necessarily restrict trade. That would be my guess as to how the spin goes.
Is that the way investors will take this?
I think investors are taking it this week as with a big question mark. Right. I mean, we started off this week in pretty solid territory, despite the fact that the trade package was passed last week. We had a really strong rally on Friday. We failed to follow through on that rally on Monday, and it's been a tough week ever since. And I think a lot of the reason for that tough week, so to speak, is this uncertainty with respect to where this administration is headed.
If 10-year treasuries go above 3.5%, what happens to the U.S. government's ability
to find... It keeps us employed.
Well, I'm hopeful for that. But how does that factor into the ability of the U.S. government to finance its debt and pay for it?
Yeah, it's going to be really tough. I think this is one of the really critical questions for this year is you've got a Fed that has to react to fiscal policy getting easier and easier, reinflating the economy, creating some degree of inflation pressure, creating better growth conditions. The natural reaction of monetary policymakers is going to be continue to tighten. If monetary policymakers continue to tighten amid that higher growth pace, rates are going to go higher. What they need to happen to fund this deficit is for growth to really skyrocket. Because if you do have much stronger growth conditions and as rates are going higher, it's not as difficult to fuel, right? The deficit looks much better in a higher growth environment than it does in a slow growth environment.
Gina Martin Adams with us of Bloomberg Equity and Bloomberg Intelligence. Can I throw you a curveball question?
Of course, Tom. I'm
on my way to spring training, so I'm all curveball now. Toys R Us blew up today. And there was a certitude about all that debt X number of years ago. Are you afeared in a general sense that we've become so complacent about debt buildup, low yield, everything's great, you know, make private equity great again? Mm. Are we setting her up for more Toys R Us's right now in the future?
I think we have a temporary reprieve from more Toys R Us's for this year specifically, because of all the cash that's coming back through repatriation, because of all the tax reform that has unlocked a degree of cash for companies, all of that's going to make EBITDA look a lot better this year than it has in the recent past. So some of your leverage ratios, particularly those that are debt relative to earnings related measures, look a lot better this year. So companies' capacity to pay improves significantly as their earnings are improving. I think Toys R Us is one case in a segment of the U.S. equity market that is continuing to struggle, and that's retail. Yeah. But you're not really seeing this in the broad sectors. I do think, should rates skyrocket, should you get a really rapid increase in rates, it makes things look a lot more difficult in future years, but it does not necessarily impact the stock market or sectors at large in the short run.
Can I put out on Twitter, Pam, the chart for Sears Holdings?
Oh, God.
SHLD.
I'm going to let Gina just...
I mean, talk about a comment talk to about that. A misery
I try
chart.
To avoid... Yeah, I'm not going there.
It's a totally new retail world.
Thank you. Yes. All right. How about a totally new tax world? I don't know whether you got a chance to listen to some of the president's remarks yesterday. He was speaking, I believe, in St. Louis.
Okay.
And topic is taxes and the potential for a second tax cut.
Really? No, I did not hear this.
Well, I mean, I said there was just a hint of it.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, you know, in the context of, we got the news today that the Dutch government is going to continue with their plan to abolish dividend taxes.
Okay.
Is this a race to the bottom when it comes to taxes? And do you think we could get another tax cut?
Wow. This is totally out of left field.
See,
I thought the president was looking at walls in California yesterday. I wasn't aware of a tax
comment.
He stopped
off.
He had his finger in the wall.
Yeah, exactly.
The Netherlands.
I thought it was.
So, you know, perhaps. I think it's a long way off.
Gina, I just put up, we do this for Gina Martin Adams and no one else, folks. We go to the weighted average cost of capital. It's a wonderful function on the Bloomberg. Sears Holdings, 88% debt with a coupon of 4.9%, which is popping conservatively 200 beeps off the 10-year yield. We have to have Gina Martin Adams back on just to go over these kind of things. When you weight the average cost of equity and debt within the present nirvana that we're in.
See, I thought he was going to ask you to weight the cost of tickets to spring training baseball.
Gina, it's
thank God. I'll take weighted average cost of capital over that any day.
we had to sell the middle daughter just to be able to swing this. Gina Martin Adams with us, Bloomberg Intelligence, working on equities. And of course, she does this with futures up 6, Dow futures up 99. Pim Fox and Tom King, we need to get the markets open. This is Bloomberg.
Well, I guess you can do an RIP for Toys R Us. And here to explain how it all happened is Stephanie Wissink, Jefferies research analyst and managing director. And yes, we're talking about the toy retail business. Stephanie, thanks very much for being with us. You say that the Toys R Us liquidation perhaps is going to send ripples through the industry. In what way?
Yeah, I think a couple of ways, and good morning. I think two things. One, clearly there are a number of toy vendors that support Toys R Us that will feel the impact of the loss of a retailer. And anytime there's a loss of the retailer, that means that there's concentration of share with other retailers. And we think the winners are most likely to be Amazon and Walmart. And both of those companies, we know, fight on price. And so as a vendor selling toys into the toy industry with two big, powerful retailers now as your lead agents for consumer buying, means that there's, you know, most likely going to be some margin pressure. I think secondarily, as we think about Toys R Us's role in the toy industry, it was definitely a destination where consumers discovered new brands and new products within the toy space. So I do think for those small and mid-sized companies, they're not going to necessarily have a venue to really build and develop their brands. So, you know, we do look for new venues to potentially unfold and emerge, where some of the inventors and some of the more innovative toy companies that are on the small and medium size can find homes for their product.
Stephanie, is this a casebook example where the actual business of toy stores is perfectly okay in the sense that you want to go and buy a toy, you want to go and see it, you want children to go and see it before they actually cost you the money to do so, but that the sort of not management, but the financial engineering behind Toys R Us is what doomed the company?
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. I think clearly the financial engineering and the financial structure of Toys R Us put pressure on its ability to invest to stay current with changes in the modern retail marketplace. I think second, though, we have seen very distinct changes in consumer behavior. One of the most unique and I think probably most prolific changes in the consumer marketplace is the changing leadership of demographics. We've moved now into a millennial-led consumer marketplace. And that millennial is a digitally native, digitally savvy, and is clearly shopping more online than prior generations. So I think that has also been unfolding in the backdrop, layering on top of this overall financial structure that was prohibitive.
Steph was sitting with us with Jefferies right now on not only consumer retail and toy industries. Your reports are wonderfully detailed about store closings and liquidations. What's the level of sweat right now? It's March. I guess they're really beginning to get ready for the fall. the winter, the Christmas season. I don't know what the schedule is. There's trade shows to go to. Forget about it all. What's the sweat level of right-sizing income statements right now?
Well, I think certainly as an academic, we need to be very thoughtful about what we think the potential residual outcome is, and not just the impact of Toys R Us, but how the consumer behavior shifts play into our considerations around profit structures. I think importantly, though, because Toys R Us is announcing its intent to liquidate across its U.S., U.K., and portions of Europe and Australia fleet, this may take many, many months. One thing that consumers are incredibly savvy about is pantry loading product when they find a great deal. So we don't necessarily know what the residual outcome is going to be in the holiday, which is where 75% of toy sales occur typically in the year. But if grandma's out shopping in August and she finds some Christmas presents that she can buy at 75 or 80% off, she might stock up on presents. And that might mean that the holiday season looks different than it has in the past. As we start to reconcile in 2019, I don't know that we'll see as much of an impact. But certainly this is going to play out over the course of the next 12 months or so before we fully appreciate what the loss of Toys R Us means to the industry.
Do we buy toys off Amazon?
Absolutely. Amazon is the fastest growing and one of the largest retailers of toys.
I find Pim, you know, and I mean, I don't need to bore Steph for this, like omnichannel. Omnichannel sounds like an MBA program at, you know, name the school.
Well, I hope omnichannel has a lot of money because you're going to need it.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, Stephanie, just a little bit here. You know, if we just go back to December, there was, of course, a court hearing about this bankruptcy filing. And the bankruptcy judge, Keith Phillips, he overruled objections by the U.S. trustee's office. They're the public watchdog, right, in these bankruptcy cases. And the judge ruled that the retailer could pay its 17 top executives $14 million in incentive bonuses. Why would they do that?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I think in the age of transparency, the consumers take issue with that when they see that occurring. And frankly, in some cases, the employees do too. I mean, Toys R Us was a very, very large retailer and employed a significant tens of thousands of people in the United States. And I think at holiday time, worldwide was extending up into the 100,000 person type range. So clearly that is a statement about, you know, protecting the interests of the executive group. But I think, again, in the age of transparency, that doesn't necessarily sit well with consumers and vendors and employees.
Well, I was going to say, and add into those investors, because Toys R Us used adjusted earnings as the benchmark for whether the executives have actually made their bonuses, right?
Correct. And that's not an uncommon approach, but it certainly doesn't sit well.
Yeah.
So I think it's not atypical. Many times pro forma or adjusted.
The head of the company, of the company, Mr. Brandon, Dave Brandon, I believe his cash compensation was $6.5 million, and he receives other long term incentives and bonuses. His brings his total annual comp to $12.5 million.
Steph, in the time we got left with you, I mean, I know they're based out of Wayne, New Jersey. Al from New Jersey, not from Wayne, New Jersey, I believe, emailed in and said, "Isn't this all about real estate? Did Toys R Us hold on so long because they had prime real estate that was a bargaining chip?"
Yeah, there is some truth to that. If you look at the consortium, this goes back to the moment when Toys R Us went private and when it was a levered buyout was used to take it private.
Yeah.
One of the three parties was a real estate operator. So there was a real estate party at the table.
Well, give us an example.
Owner of Toys R Us.
They go under, they've got some primo, I'll let you name the property, some primo property. What happens to that lease? What happens to that property?
Yeah, I think that was the reason that the real estate party was involved in the transaction originally, was to protect the real estate and protect the leasing structure. Those properties, in many cases, could be filled by a different retailer. If they are in prime locations, they are going to be in demand. I think what we're observing broadly in the national retail marketplace is that the number of neighborhood, dense neighborhood nodes where you have these big power centers is being reduced. People are spending less time in traditional bricks and mortar, and so
is that your
concentrating
prediction?
In fewer destinations. Yeah.
Is that your prediction for the future? I mean, Pim and I are seeing a slow water torture here. I mean, I don't need you to comment on Sears and that. We don't have time. But basically, Amazon's got the high ground. And this is this a look for the rest of 2018?
Well, I think it raises some very legitimate questions about experiential retail. I think retail that is succeeding in the marketplace today has a high emotional connection to the consumer, is in a category where there's a high trial and discovery area, and it offers the consumer something more than what you can experience in a mobile device or online. And I think that ultimately is going to be how the consumer prioritizes their time. If they're given an opportunity to go spend time at a restaurant with friends and enjoy an evening out, or go into a transactional venue and shop for product, they're most likely going to bias towards the experience. And so I think the more and more retailers think creatively about experiences that draw customers together, build community, connect, and ultimately community co-creates the brand experience, those are going to succeed. I think for the unfortunate thing for Toys R Us is the seasonality of the industry.
Right.
And the fact that the overall toy industry is going through these dramatic changes in how kids play today versus what they did 20 years ago.
I'm underwater. I got to get to 331. My Elf has been blown up. What's your single best buy to save me for the quarter?
Oh, boy. To save you for this quarter?
Yeah, quick.
Oh, not in the toy space. We cover the beauty space as well, and we would say Estee Lauder is still one of our favorite ideas.
Love it. Thank you so much, Stephanie. Greatly appreciate it. Stephanie Wisnick with us with Jefferies. That's great. You know, folks, Pim and I make a lot of fun with it, but literally, if I was to do an equity show, I'd call it Single Best Buy. Because you go to a two-hour meeting with somebody on the sell side, and it's blah, 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 blah. All everybody wants to know is, what's the single best buy
right now? Yeah.
Estee Lauder.
Estee Lauder. All right. You know how many employees Toys R Us has?
I heard
30,000.
30,000.
Over 30,000 people. 740 stores.
Yeah.
You know who did the private buyout? KKR. Mm-hmm. Yeah. $6.6 billion. They got $5 billion in debt.
We say good morning to those from KKR listening. We really appreciate your attendance. The Dow up 39. Stay with us through the day. This is Bloomberg Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.